promises to be another very interesting session. For those of you who weren't just here when I asked a question, my name is Laura Weiner. I'm Associate Director of Teaching and Learning Services, and it's my pleasure to moderate this panel today, and I'm taking over so that David Harp can actually be a panel member and actually get to participate in that role and give him a break from moderating. So I just would like to get a sense of who is in the room. And that will help I think it will help the panelists. It will also help me in terms of moderating the discussion. How many of you have used lecture recordings in the past? Quick show of hands. Okay. Well, yes. Panelists do not have to answer these questions. How many of you are hoping, are in a decision mode and hoping that what you hear today will help you decide? And how many of you are just curious? Okay, so a lot of people have experience. That's an interesting perspective. And just to get a sense of where you're from, how many of you are from health sciences? From science and engineering? And social sciences and humanities? That would be those that are left, but I don't remember, so. You're from social sciences, arts, faculty of arts. You're in one of those, Carolyn. Just to give you a brief sense of the context at McGill, we have two systems for doing lecture recording. One is a hardware solution that provides automatic recording capability. This is available in 37 different classrooms across campus. The list is available. I think I just typed in lecture recording rooms on the McGill website and somehow got to the list in a fairly straightforward fashion. So that was how I knew that there were 37. And there are also software solutions that allow an instructor to record from anywhere at any time. And both of these can be, a recording made using either of these options can be posted for students to review. And our goal today is not to really debate the relative advantages of different solutions. So we're going to try not to get down into the weeds of, you know, which software program is better, or should it be hardware-based or software-based, but really talk about the impact on teaching and learning that the panelists who represent professors and students with a significant amount of experience in this area, what impact have they found on the teaching and learning process. Each panelist will have 4 to 5 minutes to present the three most important impacts that they have found, that they've observed or experienced, and then we're going to open it up to discussion, and I would imagine that it will be lively given that I know the panelists. So I'd like to start by asking David to begin.
Okay, thank you.
You're going to stay there? Perfect.
Can you tune me up? Yeah. There, that's good. Well, I use this. Many of my colleagues in chemistry use this technology. One of the main reasons that I at least got involved and wanted to be involved in it was that I'm confronted with very large classes, anywhere from 100 up to 600 and more. And given that that's what we have to deal with, it's not going to be, in most cases, or certainly not for me, classes of 10 and 20, where I think this might not be as advantageous or necessary. The idea was that we're confronted with the lecture system, and with a lecture system these days, it's possible to prepare a really fully visual, animated kind of presentation for the students, and it always has struck me from the day I started here at McGill some years ago, is that if it's really a reasonable lecture and well prepared, how is it that everybody has to be there at the same time to hear the words when they, in fact, will disappear into the ether? So I've always felt there was a place for recording of some kind, and we all know, if you're back in the 70s when small tape recorders were available, the front of a dais in Leacock looked a lot like a news conference of some kind, and where students trying to record to capture those moments. So that's at least reason one, is that it seems reasonable to have the students available for the students to reconnect in one way or another, should they not be there for illness or religious purposes or whatever other reason, and even idiosyncratic reasons of just not going to class. It seems we can't really differentiate those. And so it's available for the students in that regard. I assessed the last 10 years that I've been using, or we in the chemistry department have been using, where it started, this kind of technology, and I've had 56 courses with about 18,000 students. And those numbers are reflected these days. In this last year at McGill, over 300 courses were recorded with a potential audience of about 50,000. Many of the students counted more than once. In fact, I talked to a student yesterday, had all 10 courses this year were recorded a student in science. And, of course, many others have maybe none or one. See, that's at least part of the reason. The other reason, two other quick reasons, would be that students are very appreciative. This is shown in giving surveys over all of these 10 years, pretty much every year, asking how they feel. I'll go into those numbers a little later. And the other is that the performance on very similar exams over this 10-year period in these many courses have not revealed a downward trend at all. In fact, if it's anything, it's slightly going upwards, but it's certainly not going downwards. Another quick comment to make about all of this is that students appreciate in ways that I think we would all enjoy. They come up afterwards and say this really helped them. If you ask them, they take it for granted, it's true, but if you say to them, what if this were removed, how would you feel? And you get a stare that is a little hard to comprehend when they say, you're not serious about doing this. And I said, well, no, I don't make that call. But they make it very clear that they hope that this can be a part of their learning process and their assistance. It's really a help, we feel, many of us, for the students overall. So maybe I'll just pass this along, these being the three major reasons, and we'll come to other comments a little later.
Great. So I'll turn to Paul Lasko from the Department of Biology.
Okay. Thanks for having me here. I'll try to be brief, and I just want to share with you my experiences with course recordings over the years. So I've been here for 20 years. For the first 10 of those years, I taught 300-level courses in biology for enrollments of 100 to 200 students. And for the last 10 years, I've taught 200-level courses in biology with enrollments of 500 or 600 or 700 students, so large lecture courses. And all of those courses for the whole 20 years have been recorded with whatever technology was available at the time. So a long experience with this. So initially, and even going back to when I was a student back sometime in the Middle Ages, courses were recorded, and the purpose of the recordings was primarily to serve as a backup. So when I started teaching here, as David said, audio recordings were taken of courses. Actually, the rooms have built-in ancient cassette recorders. They probably still exist in some of the rooms. And the library would issue you a shoebox full of cassettes at the beginning of the term, and you'd dutifully do one every day. And then those cassettes would go on reserve in the library, and students could, if they missed class for whatever reason, could go and access those cassettes. So the material was recorded. People who wanted to review things could do it. But it wasn't quite the same as going to the lecture. And enrollment, attendance at lectures, most of the students in the class showed up at lecture on a given day. Since then, technology's improved, and I've started teaching the larger courses. And when the technology improved initially, I embraced it tremendously because my course was reaching the point where it exceeded the capacity of Leacock 132. So we thought, ha-ha, we'll just open a second section, a second room, and we'll pipe the recording into the second room, and then everybody can see this. And we got all kind of flack for that. The students hated it. I think we even made it into the Gazette. And within a week, we had to make sure we had a live professor available to teach both sections of the course. So that it was clearly, the recordings were clearly not seen at that time, which was probably 6 or 7 years ago, as a substitute for a live professor. But what's been happening since, although we still have capacity for everybody here, a live professor, is that the attendance in the courses I teach has been gradually dropping and dropping and dropping and dropping and dropping until I would say this last semester I had probably 20 to 30% attendance in my class. So we have a course of 700 and some odd students where I was lecturing mostly to a sea of empty chairs in Leacock 132 with scattered students sitting around. So I think that the use of the recordings has really changed in that We have a substantial fraction of students now who are primarily accessing our courses remotely. And that has ramifications for what the university is like, because we have a substantial number of students then who are only engaging personally with the university when they have to come in for an exam or when they have to come in for a lab. And I would agree with David, I don't think they're necessarily doing any worse. In fact, these courses are populated with a lot of U1 students right out of CEGEP who probably live locally with their family. They're pre-medical students who probably got A's. They might find some of these material kind of easy, and they feel, well, I can just, you know, sit home and pick this up as I need it. So I don't know that they're necessarily doing badly, but it really changes the nature of the university, because to a large extent, it's become a distance learning experience, at least in the U1 year, for a lot of life science students. And so my own view, when you say yes or no, I think the recordings are very important to have as a resource, but I'd like to see somehow to explore how we can get them back to not being the primary mode of delivery for a lot of students, but a resource that people can access as they need to.
Thank you, Paul. We'll now turn to somebody else who teaches large classes, Ken Reagan from the Department of Physics.
Okay, hi. I have a preamble and then sort of three major points that I want to bring up that aren't really the most important impacts, just things that I think one wants to consider. Some of them have been touched on. But first, how about those Habs? Who's been following the Habs? Isn't that fantastic? So I've got two tickets for tonight's game. Anybody want them? Who wants them? Seriously, I'm going to give them away. Who wants them? Okay. Who wants two tickets for the Habs for tonight? Okay, good. We'll come back to that point. So my preamble is where I'm coming from, and that is that I also teach, like Paul and Dave, I teach these big freshman classes, and there are several hundred students. And so my take on this is very largely governed by how this has worked or hasn't worked in the last several years as my courses have been recorded. So the three points I want to make are, the first one's about technology. Laura doesn't want us to talk about which technology is better, and that's not where I'm going with this. It's the fact that I think it's important that there is this technology and that we should embrace it. And that's not because it's unremittently good, but because we can't possibly imagine what its positive impact is. If you had gone back, say, if you go back 5 years or 7 years or 10 years, and you ask yourselves, what did you know about Twitter and Facebook? The answer would probably be zero, and you could not imagine how students today use it. I can't imagine how students today use it, or even my own kids. And I suspect that the technology of course recordings is a little bit like that, in the sense that we see potentially the downsides, but we can't see the upsides because those are still to be explored by the students, and they will find imaginative and useful ways to use them, and we should not preclude them from doing that. I had one student, when I pulled my course, I had one student come to me and say, well, I use them absolutely all the time because I never go to your courses. And I said, well, you know, why don't you? What am I doing wrong? She said, you're not doing anything wrong. It's simply that I actually double-teamed two courses at exactly the same time, and I have to because of the requirements for my degree, and yours is recorded and the other one isn't, so I look on yours every single night after your course. I follow your course by the course recordings. Well, so there's a student whose degree, I was about to say whose life has been immeasurably improved, but no, whose degree has been measurably shortened by not having to take one additional term just for my course, because my course was a required part of her program. So I think technology, we shouldn't sort of be reticent about it. We should recognize that it's out there, and potentially students will find very positive ways to use it, and I think that's good. The second point is that I think there is a discomfort factor. One of them is attendance, and we've just heard Dave say no noticeable change of attendance, and Paul say noticeable change of attendance.
No noticeable change of grades.
Oh, I'm sorry, grades. Oh, okay, well,
there is a noticeable change of attendance.
Okay, so they both agree on noticeable change of attendance. That's good. I can't see that in my own data, simply because I believe that there are other larger issues, such as, you know, when the chemistry exam is, when the Habs are playing, etc. So, so I think that there is a discomfort about attendance. And that's something that I think we just, at some level, have to live with. And I'm going to address it a little bit in my third point. But there's also a discomfort, at least from my own point of view, there's a discomfort with sort of being out there. Okay, I'm a little worried. We've all seen things go viral on YouTube. And if it goes viral in a great way, the Susan O'Boyle way, okay, terrific. But if it goes viral and you turn out to be the kid that everybody's laughing at, you don't want to be there, right? So there's a discomfort factor when I talk to my colleagues about, do you really want your lecture recordings online? Okay, I think that's just something you have to live with. I tell off-color jokes sometimes, and sometimes they fall flat, okay? That's something that I've got to live with. I think that the positives outweigh that potential discomfort. But there is a discomfort factor, and I think we need to address it. And, individuals need to address it in their own frame as to whether they're comfortable with that. The third point, I think, is something I haven't heard before, although Paul perhaps touched on a little bit, and I think it's really the key point. And that is that we live in a world in which if we don't have these course recordings, it really doesn't matter, because these people on Facebook, our students on YouTube or 100 other sites, can have tremendous videos of what they're trying to learn. They can find Oxford University Nobel Prize winning physicists talking to them about quantum mechanics. They can find MIT Nobel Prize winning people talking to them about economics. They can find Brian Greene with the Nova Show, and it's all free online. So what's my value added being in front of that course? It's not necessarily my course recording. My course recording is what I did in the course, but in fact, these people can find superior ways of presenting that same material out there online. So I've got to ask myself, why do I want these people in my class? Why do I want warm bodies in front of me? I do. I mean, I'm very human. I kind of don't like to lecture to 20 people in a 600-person auditorium. But what is the value added? And that comes back to the Habs question. How many of you wanted tickets for the Habs tonight? A whole bunch, right? But, you know, if you look on it, if you watch it online or on TV, you get 20 different camera angles, all the slow-mo replays, you can get up and get another cold beer, and you don't pay $12 for the beer. And yet, the Habs fill every seat. Why? Not because there's interactivity, right? When was the last time you could interact with one of those people on the Habs? You don't. But we've got to be asking ourselves, how do we get those seats full? What's our value added? And I think the value added is, in fact, not what the Habs have. It's the interactivity. It's the fact that they can interrupt me. They can ask me. I can make mistakes in real time, and they can see that that's not the end of the world if the professor actually goes off down a tangent and then realizes this isn't the way to attack a problem. The real way is that way. And that is a very valuable learning experience to them. So I think the key, the third point, my third point was this issue of what's our value added. That's what you've got to be asking yourselves. And I guess the way to quantify it is, if you believe that a student in your class can get everything that you deliver in that classroom through a lecture, well, then there's something wrong. Because ultimately, if they learn that, the university administration will learn that, and they will say, why don't we just fire you and keep the lecture recording? And that's something that we should be worried about, because there is value added. It's not, I don't want guaranteed employment. I believe there's value added. I do want guaranteed employment, too. But I believe there's value added in what I do, being in front of students and having them there live. And lecture recordings are a great tool. I think we should let students, of course, use them, and I think they will use them in imaginative ways, but ultimately the question that they really bring up is, what's our value add?
Thank you, okay. Ken. I'll go now to Eugene Daniels from the Faculty of Medicine.
Okay, I'll take another approach and ask a question. Recording is a good approach for all programs. Now referring to the professional programs that are different to a certain degree from the other undergraduate programs. And I'll tell you about our experiences in the medical and dental professional programs. In the past, attendance in the classes were always good until it started to be recorded. And I'll give you examples of that in a little while. But why is it being recorded? The main reason why they were being recorded was that the accreditation committees, professional accreditation committees, required that there should be more free time for students for independent study, and they suggested that the number of lectures should be reduced considerably, and it should never be more than 50% of the total teaching time. So that makes the lecture very, very important when it's given, and we really need students to interact with the teacher at that time. So the few lectures are not only to give the essential elements of that important subject, but also to set out a roadway in which they can have independent studies. So we feel as teachers that the lecture is now very, very important. And I'd like to emphasize why it became more important. Because if you look at the undergraduate medical class, they come from a very wide background of education, There's a very large number of CCHAP students. They're students with science, masters, and PhDs. It's a very heterogeneous group, and all of them have practically no background in essentials in medicine. So the big challenge here is to, with that big group, we'd like to have the students together where you can interact and start off by anchoring this information so that they can go out and study on their own. So we really like to have students present. So what problems we encounter here, we're very specific subject matter, which we present in a very synchronized fashion. So if students don't attend and they learn in a very asynchronous fashion, it creates problems for the professor. And we've experienced that students who have not attended will come to a professor after the lecture and ask about information that occurred a long time ago. So we feel that the lecture has another role of pacing the student in their learning so that they can all keep up to date. And there are many exams in the medical faculty. There are 7 courses in first year, and it could be about 14 exams. So we like to have them all keeping up to date. We pace them, and then we could, when they're examined, we feel that they have accomplished and completed all the information. When students do not attend, we never know if they completed all the required essential information that's required by the professional schools. And our testing represents a problem. Most of our exams are multiple choice, so we're not quite sure if these students have a certain level of competency that should be acquired in this profession. So I would say lecture recording plays a very important role if it is used as a complement to the lecture, but not as an alternative. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And wanting to give the last word to the students, Mitran Mehta, who's a science undergraduate student.
Yes. Hi. So prior to this event, I set my Facebook status and my MSN nickname asking about lecture recordings. And it should be no surprise that all my friends who are McGill students were all supporting lecture recordings. They were just like, make sure they don't take it away, make sure they don't take it away. So generally, like, I've been at McGill for 3 years now, and most of my classes have been recorded. And I would also like to commend the chemistry department for providing recordings over the cool software system and WebCT. So thank you very much. I passed those classes because of those. But the dilemma we are all here to address are the pros and cons of lecture recording system. The pros are simple and concise in that they allow students to be malleable with their schedule, as Professor Reagan said, and that the students can also partake in extracurricular activities, from protesting George Bush on the weekday to going and helping out at the local homeless shelter, that students can come back home in the evening and catch up to lectures. And also, there's always those students who also miss class by taking a nap during class time in LECOG 132. There are some cons as well, and the biggest one concern that all the professors have raised is that attendance is one of the main priority. And I find that generally, even in my classes when I go, that once midterm starts coming in, which is in October and February, attendance just drops. It's because that the midterms are packed together. Within 1 week, some students have 3 to 4 midterms, and some students have no midterms. So it's an area we can look at. So there are, like, no simple solutions, but some of the ideas that I asked my friends and my people who voted me into my position, like, what are the ideas that, what can we work with? Some of the students suggested that we should spread out our midterms, so there should not be concentrated in 1 week or 2 weeks in October and February, whereas some of the first-year core freshman courses can work together and spread out the midterms from September till November. We can also work to have multiple midterms. I find that some of the biology classes only have one midterm worth 30%, so students do not come to class and they spend the entire day cramming for that midterm. But if we have multiple midterms, it would give less weight on those exams and allow students to be very work with come to lectures and still get A's. Aside from that, I've heard some other professors also, some professors don't record the lectures, and the primary complaint is that it's copyright material, or it could be that people might take it out of context. Not the students themselves, but if the lecture recordings are available publicly, some people who might not be at McGill might get their hands on the lecture recordings and take the information out of context. And that's the ideas that I've heard and the opinions I've heard from everybody, and I shared them with you. So there are many ideas of work here, and I look forward to hearing your questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And since the chemistry department was mentioned by name, I will give David a chance to comment.
I think a lot of this is, particularly with respect to the professional programs, is that it depends. It depends on the time of day. It depends on the season of the year. In the middle of February, in an evening course, which we have in Leacock, which is 2.5 hours, I have to concur with some of the students. It's dark and it's cold, and they have a midterm the next day, and they live in the West Island, and they can't really logically get back in any easy way before 10 p.m., so they often take it directly in that fashion. There's another comment I wanted to make in that I think there's an advantage that I don't think people are using all as much as they might use, and I've had a great success, I think, with three different TAs over the last 5 years in organic chemistry, is that in many schools, as one contrast to what I want to say, is that the TAs are required to go to the faculty lectures so that they are up to date with the students and not being saying, oh, he didn't tell you that? Oh, I can tell you something much better, which is a little bit discoordinate with what we might like. And so what can happen is that if the lectures have been recorded for the previous year, or even during that particular year, the TA can access these maybe while making dinner or at some convenient time rather than breaking up their particular research day, and keep abreast. This last year, I had several comments in the organic class. I share it with one other professor, and several students talked about the trio, which I thought was really pretty good. It was the TA and the two professors, myself and another prof, and how they were in synchrony with what was going on. That's one feature that I think is useful. For the faculty person, it's really helpful, I have found, to review briefly. I don't sit there online and listen to my lecture for the whole time. That's a little too much. But what I have done many times is sort of take segments and say, okay, how did I treat that? I've kind of forgotten. And I come up with sometimes a point that I haven't made clear or wasn't clear to my memory. Another is that the modules on a separate system can be prepared where students maybe didn't know a particular topic well, and a whole subtopic could be put forward for those who need a little backup material. And the one that I like the most is taking a midterm apart with a tablet PC and write out the structures and the coordinates as I would have had them answer it and comment on how well they did on the multiple choice part, how well they did on the written part, and give every student a chance to review in that way. And maybe one last little comment to make is on evaluations. I think most of us here are users of clickers. I know Ken Reagan is an enthusiastic user, and so have many of us in chemistry been. Clickers generally get a rating of about 3.5 out of 5 in our evaluations, which I think is very good, and I use them in all my classes. That essentially means that one person will rate it at 5 out of 5, 2 will rate it at 4, and 7 will rate it at 3. And it's a very good rating, and it's a superb system, and I like it. The lecture recordings, when asked the same question from clickers and lecture recordings, how well does this help you learn, do you strongly agree, etc., it's just the inverse. It's 7 rating it at 5, 2 rating it at 4, and 1 rating it at 3, and the ratings are 4.6 almost every year, the same number, maybe 4.7 sometimes. So that's just some statistical background that delivers what I said at the very beginning, is that the students have made their vote count by saying that it works for them and it helps them. And I have to admit that having a smaller number in class, it is disconcerting and a bit uncomfortable, but I think the message is that we have to park the egos at the door and address those students who are there, and in some cases it makes a smaller, tighter class, and we just have to look at it as a glass half full, or maybe a shade less than half full sometimes when midterms are on.
Thank you, David. Very interesting comments. I invite anybody who has a question to come to the mic. In the meantime, I think what I heard that was most interesting was the impact that people felt it had on the students' relationship with the course and with the university. And I think that that's a softer, fuzzier area that you can't necessarily capture by looking at grades and even course evaluations, but this issue of creating a sense of community within a class or to the university is a very interesting one. Paul, and if you want to speak, please go to the mic. Thank you. Did you want to comment, Paul?
Yeah, I'd just like to add one comment. I find that that disengagement finds its way to other parts of the academic experience. So in this course, we also have teaching assistants who give conference sections. And when you have a course of 700 students, it's good for them. Not all of them will have the guts to put up their hand and lecture, even if not all of them show up and lecture. A lot of them will. But we have conference sections so they can bring their questions to TAs and discuss the material in a more intimate setting, of course. And there are only four TAs in this course, which is a ridiculously small number for such a large course. Nevertheless, the conference sections are pretty much empty. And I would say fewer than 10% of the students in the course regularly access the conference sections. Even though, so they're there, they're at reasonably convenient times, they don't go to them. And I think they don't go because there's already this sense that this is a course you do remotely, and there just doesn't seem to be the desire on a lot of, you know, I think because of that, there's not the desire to really engage in a personal level and actually discuss material. It becomes a bit of a passive experience where there's material that's out there in the recording and that's what you're responsible for, and you know the rest doesn't matter so much.
Thank you, Paul. I think if you could just introduce yourself,
Joe. Joe Schwartz from chemistry.
Hey,
about the tickets for tonight.
It's a random draw. I've stuffed the ballot box.
If you ask any player in the NHL what city they like to play in most, it's Montreal. There's no question about it. And the reason, of course, is the crowd. Because you are on a stage performing, and you're appreciated, and you perform better. Now, for us in Montreal, this is not great because the opposing players here put out more than the Canadians who are used to it.
It's good if you want to see good hockey.
Yeah. But this is the one thing that, you know, that I find is that when you're faced with 600 eager students there in front of you, you somehow want to put out more than if you're faced with about 40 or 50. And I don't know if there's, you know, a way around that. I mean, the Canadians analogy, I think, is a very good one. On the other hand, I got to tell you that I do have access to tickets pretty well whenever I want. And I've gone to two games this year. And the reason for that is, frankly, I'd rather sit at home in front of my large flat screen, with my personal recorder so I can review, right? And I see it better, I see it cleaner, and I don't have to put up with the damn organ or with the T-shirts being hurled into the crowd, which is a travesty. Okay. So I think, get more out of it, although I think if I were a player, I'd certainly want the full crowd there. And so this is a dichotomy. But
I'd just like to interject one thing there. I think that there's an analogy being brought up between the experience in a classroom and entertainment that is a very interesting line. And obviously, if you're in front of 600 people, it is a performance to some extent. But is that all it is? And should it be a performance in the way of, why don't we just hire actors, you know, give them the script, and we've got lots of out-of-work actors,
well, actually,
and we can get them.
We do have many actors who are playing the role of professors.
Yeah. Well, that's a different thing, Joe. We're not going to go there. Yeah.
Well, if Joe's finished, I'll definitely. Yeah. So I think.
So there are no tickets for tonight.
No.
Stick around. Who knows? You'll have to stick around to the end of the lecture to find out. Okay. So I think Joe brings up a couple of really great points, not about the haves, but about the performance. I think anybody who has lectured in front of a large class recognizes that there's an element of performance art. Generally, of course, I think departments recognize that as well and tend to put people in those situations that will be able to deal with them. But it's clear, this comes back to my point about value added, it's clear that if you don't do that, if you don't approach it a little bit as performance art, but really just believe that you can stand up and deliver a completely bland lecture with PowerPoint and nothing else, never step away from your podium and do nothing else, then the person may as well watch it online, a video recording. So performance art is absolutely there. Now, so why don't we just hire performance artists to do this? The Cirque du Soleil will, I'm sure, be able to rent us people. They may actually be better paid than we are, first of all. Okay, but the issue is, and I think it was very interesting that you chose to use the word script. The point is that we know our scripts backward and forward, but we also know how to deviate from the script, right? We can ad-lib, and that is the improvisation part. The fact is that, you know, if it was just a script, you could put it in the hands of anybody to teach Physics 101, which is what I teach. But as soon as the question that is asked is a little bit off the beaten topic, how does that fold in with, you know, last week's launch of a space shuttle and the energetics of that? Then if you don't know the script, the person from Cirque du Soleil who won't know the script is lost. And that's why this improvisation, this idea that that the expert in the material that you're teaching actually can make connections based on the questions that are asked by the people, by the audience, by the students, I think that becomes the real the value added.
And,
the reason
and your answer is predicated upon the assumption that the students will have a chance to ask questions, which is...
Absolutely, which means it's got to be interactive.
Right. Yeah, Paul, and then we'll...
I've always tried to be an interactive teacher, and the most fun I had teaching was in those first 10 years when I always taught with chalk on a blackboard. And it was interactive with the students, and a student would sometimes ask a question that would send me off on something for 15 minutes, and that was probably the best part of the lecture. And that started to become difficult to do once PowerPoint really came in, and I resisted PowerPoint for a long time, because now you have to put the PowerPoint slides on WebCT. And so even if in response to a student's question, you go off for 15 minutes to talk about something else, well, now you haven't covered the material. And now when 70% of the students sometimes are only accessing what you've put out there on the web, and haven't heard that interaction that you had in class, and also didn't have the same opportunity to send your lecture down some other pathway, then you have two populations of students. When the time comes around to test them, you know, then you can only really rely on what you put out there in the recording. And so it tends to encourage you then to just stand in front of the PowerPoint and you know, do what it says so that everybody gets the same material.
Thank you, Paul. We have a question.
Ariel Fenster from Chemistry. I think we have too much of a tendency to worry about this attendance business. I mean, essentially what we want to have a full classroom. So it's true there may be in a 600 classroom we have only 200 students, but it's easy to solve. Just put them in 200 classroom seats. I mean, then you have no, I'm not joking. This is essentially what it is, and we can do that. But what I want to... We have talked a lot about the benefits to the student. I want to address the benefit to the teacher. And I find, in fact, lecture recording has changed a lot my style of teaching, and I believe for the better. Because I know that the students that come to class want to come to class, and because of the fact that they have the slides, the selected slide printed, it's available on WebCT, they come with a selected slide. And I know, and I notice this, that I have the one that come, want to come, and I have their full attention. And that is very important. Now, I remember when I went to school also ages ago, I remember it was always like this, or when I started teaching, I had the students in front of me, and what did he say? Now I know that the students, they listen and they appreciate what I say, and because they know that they can go back, if they have missed something, they can go back and look it up again. And I think this is really, it makes the whole lecturing more pleasant because the students are more relaxed.
Thank you.
Just a really brief response.
Okay, and then we'll go to our last question.
Really brief response to your first point. I totally agree with you. I'd love to move the class to a room with 200 students, but you're not allowed to do that. So you're obligated to, you can only exceed the capacity of a room by 7%. And that's something really the university should revisit, especially in the context of some discussion of building an 800-seat lecture hall. We have a lot of courses on paper that have that kind of enrollment, but in practice, you don't need an 800-seat lecture hall necessarily.
Okay. David, quick comment, and then we'll
go actually, on that very point, when we started doing lecture recordings 10 years ago, it was clear that you could, in fact, overbook. I have it written from Morton Mendelssohn that he says, if you're using lecture recording, you can overbook. The 7% rule is sort of passé, and I think it could be. And, in fact, we've done this with one class by having that group come in a room that really doesn't hold it at all, and it works very well, just as Ariel just pointed out. But I agree it will be difficult with a 600 person because those powers that coordinate this are going to be reluctant, but it could work.
Can
okay, just very briefly, I'm reluctant to always bring up different analogies, but I don't like when Air Canada overbooks, and I don't think we should be overbooking. I'm okay with 7%, actually, 10%, 15%. But I think if you're starting to rely on overbooking, if you've got an 800-person class and you're planning to put them in a 300-person auditorium, you're effectively saying to the class, 5/8 of you, I don't want you there.
And, no, you're not.
And that's, well, implicitly that is the message.
I think we don't want to go. Two interesting sides of an argument. We have two people who have been very patient, and then we're going to have to stop, but I want to make sure they get a chance. Why don't we hear from, it's a student has a comment.
Actually, my Physics 101 class, the added value was Professor Reagan did interactive demonstrations of concepts such as center of gravity. He asked a student volunteer to sit on a chair, and he tended to rotate the student. It was really fun to watch, and it made me understand. And then a lot of professors tend to, organic chemistry professors, they use chemical model kits, and you can't really do organic chemistry on a PowerPoint. You need to see the 3D structures. So they do that in class, and one of my organic chemistry professors always used to warn, is like, people listening at home, you are pretty much screwed because you don't get to see this. So it's the added value of going to class is that it's not just that the professor and it's a performance, is that there's a whole body language that you're missing out, and if you look at basic communication, 80% is body language or nonverbal, then you're missing out on all of that. You're missing out on the emphasis the professor is making. So that's the benefit of going to class.
Okay, Eugene?
I just want to add that I teach a course of embryology, and students have a problem understanding three-dimensional concepts. So the way I do that is that I partially fill in the diagram, and they fill and construct the developing embryo with me. So that's a kind of interactive type of development. So they gain by that. Most of the students say they gain by that. And I think it also helps them in learning right at the lecture. They don't just go and listen to a recording. They get some concepts. They go home. They can listen to the recording later on and then see if there's any problems. So there is a big value of interacting with the student in the lecture.
As I suspected, this topic is generating a lot of interest and conversation, but it's going to be like at the supermarket. Cynthia, the line is closed after you. Okay, but Kevin.
Kevin Wade, Animal Science. I've been using lecture recording for about 4 or 5 years, and I don't have the 600 students like some of you guys. I don't have to perform, perhaps. But there's been about 60, and it's a first-year course. And I think there's a couple of other advantages. First of all, in our faculty, the majority of the students, or a large percentage, are francophone. And so they'll come into the lecture, they'll hear it, and then they'll go home, they'll listen again, because more and more our professoriate is becoming international as well. And when I started, I had a thicker Irish accent, and I spoke too fast, so they appreciated being able to listen to it again. That's the first one. The second one is probably all of you have read that poem, The Lecture Paradigm, this thing about, are you going to give us the PowerPoint in advance? Well, if you don't, we're going to have to spend time taking notes. If I do give it to you, what's the point in coming? We have it all already. And so my philosophy for the first-year students has been not to give them anything in advance, but to record the whole lecture, make them interact, make them think, and then put the PowerPoint and the lecture on afterwards. So I think that's been a compromise, because I've had this every year, why don't you give us the slides in advance? And the third, perhaps personal thing, is this time last year I had to leave for some personal reasons, and it was really neat to be able to take the six lectures from last year and just slip them into WebCT, and they were able to follow it. It works for a first-year course because it's pretty structured. For the higher ones, it doesn't work as well.
Thank you, Kevin. David has a quick comment.
Just a very brief comment. One way that students can be induced to go to classes, which they do at Berkeley, they record, and then they don't put the lectures up for 10 or 12 days. And if anything, any prof is talking about exams and what's going to be on it, they turn off the recording. I just find this absurd, but that's that will induce them to come back, but they're coming back for wrong reasons, I think. Mm-hmm.
Cynthia?
A final comment that I think some really great examples have been given as to how you can have the value added in the face-to-face part, which I think is absolutely right on, that there are things that should be happening face-to-face that you can't do in another way. And I'd be glad for both the lecture recording and for the social networking that we just had previously for us to jointly work on putting together some seminars or something where people could really brainstorm that, as the gentleman just said, could we have a chance to really talk about some specific things that can be done with social networking and in the lecture formats.
Thank you. I'd like to thank the panel for their contributions today and thank all of you for participating. We will take a 5 to 10 minute break.
Not more than 10.
8 minute break.
I'm back in command.
Oh, because David's back at the helm, so it's going to be a tighter ship again. Thank you all very much.